During my time in Number 10, the person I most missed was a good, reliable poisoner. The Master. At more or less the same time that the Home Secretary and the Prime Minister were being ushered into a private dining room for lunch, back in London, Murdoch White's son, a laboratory technician at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in Bloomsbury, was munching a sandwich in the street as he waited for Mrs. Wilkinson. All an observer would have noticed was a pale, nervous young man in jeans greeting an elderly lady in a headscarf, before passing her something tightly wrapped in a plastic bag. His mother or aunt? A little domestic shopping? It was a touching little urban vignette. But the future of the United Kingdom was contained in that plastic bag. Eileen Wilkinson unwrapped it gingerly back in Downing Street, having first put on a pair of latex gloves. This was wise, because the fluid in the glass bottle inside the bag had been infected by Banquo White with Coxsackie B virus. Mrs. Wilkinson got methodically to work. With some careful sluicing and smearing, she transmitted the virus to the china cup Ulwin Grimaldi used for his breakfast milk. No serious crime was being committed. Coxsackie B virus is not fatal or even particularly serious. It causes Bornholm disease, characterized by diarrhea and a sharp pain on one side of the chest. Known as the devil's grip or the grasp of the phantom, its effects generally last no longer than a week. Ulwin Grimaldi, a creature of habit and a man of milky decency, had no obvious vices for an enemy to exploit. He could not be blackmailed. He was, in his way, a man of dogged persistence and some courage. To start with, without Eileen Wilkinson's observant presence, the master and his circle would never have known that he suffered so acutely from hypochondria. Hypochondria, so easy to mock. What the Prime Minister really suffered from was a terror of early death. It wasn't a fussy obsession with liver spots or winter coughs. It was a genuine, well-founded awareness of oblivion. Grimaldi's father had died early of a stroke, his mother of breast cancer. To the Prime Minister, Caroline Phillips's gently probing question in the car on the way to Windsor had been like the sudden extinction of the sun behind a dark cloud. Despite his terrors, Grimaldi had fought on. His determination to stifle his night fears took considerable courage. In recent months, as the American pressure for a new security and defence agreement had weighed ever more heavily upon him, he had become more dogged, not less. Ulwin Grimaldi might even have shaken off the devil's grip, which would get its fingers into him later that evening. But Mrs. Wilkinson was a dogged and well-connected woman. The master's wife remained a friend, and was close to Farah Clara Jenkinson, who had unwittingly provided the final solution. For bizarre though it may seem, what finished off the premiership of Ulwin Grimaldi was a humble but inexplicably fashionable vegetable. As Farah Clara had once mentioned to Sadie in passing, if you eat sufficient beetroot quickly enough, the symptom of what appears to be severe rectal bleeding becomes all too apparent. Beetroot had therefore featured heavily in the Prime Minister's diet in the days leading up to his meeting with the King, and beyond that, when he was virally infected. The combination of weakness, pain in his chest, and apparent hemorrhage exhausted Ulwin's resources. Lying in bed early one morning, soaked in sweat, the devil's grip around his chest and blood on the sheets, he telephoned his private Harley Street doctor. This doctor had once faced a GMC inquiry which he had survived. He had never forgotten the handwritten note of support that arrived from Downing Street during the Master's era. No physical examination was required that day. What was happening was all too obvious. and the doctor's tone of voice confirmed everything Alwyn needed to know. He ended the conversation, then dialed again, this time his private secretary, who put him through to Windsor Castle. His Majesty was properly concerned and sympathetic, just as his mother had been when Harold Macmillan had found himself in a similar fix. There was no need for an undignified rush. A full consultation in Harley Street would be required, and then, as soon as it could be arranged, the Cabinet would have to be informed. Alwyn Grimaldi would remain as leader of the party until the forthcoming party conference in Stoke. He'd put in place the formal mechanisms for a change of leadership and would remain as Prime Minister until his successor emerged from the vote of party members and MPs. The Prime Minister felt intense relief. Mortally ill though he was, he managed to shower, dress, and eat a poached egg on brown toast for breakfast. Mortally ill though he was, he felt curiously vigorous as he planned the day ahead. It was like the flush of energy that often follows a bereavement. There were so many things to do, so many people to tell. But Alwyn felt something akin to gratitude. The great burden was being taken away, and he could at last acknowledge privately to himself that he'd never known what to do with it in the first place. Even his new plan for relaunching the government wasn't really his plan. It was fraught with difficulties ahead. The jealousy of competing companies, the inevitable accusations of favouritism, and the revelation of scandals involving the favoured chosen ones. Well, let Mrs. Caroline Phillips, he supposed it would be her, deal with all of that. He would watch from his hospital bed. The Choice.